Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
We're going to talk about bug attack, and in this under this lecture today, we're going to talk about some infections that have been mostly in the media, and some things that we think you should be concerned and more educated about as well. And then Dr. Smolin's going to step in after me and talk a little bit about the bioterrorism agents that have been used in war and have also been in the media. So a lot of this is clear up some misunderstanding about a lot of things we've been hearing about in the media, and try to quell some fears and also get a little education out of this as well. So my background is I'm actually Canadian by birth, but don't hold that against me because I naturalized and moved to Oregon. I've actually been a duck all my life, and went to school there and then head out to East to University of Rochester for medical school. And then was lucky enough to be in New York for my emergency medicine training, where I was even luckier enough, although unfortunate, to be there during 9/11, which sort of solidified my choice in going into emergency medicine. I then went up to Boston and worked at the Brigham, for any of you Bostonites out there, and then went and got my MPH from Harvard as well, which is sort of the reason why I'm doing a lot of this, is because my MPH was focused on a lot of public education using media and communications about spreading a lot of medical knowledge to the public, and which is why a lot of the projects I do now evolve around public education. And my trip back to San Francisco General was primarily for family, but it's been a great experience since I'm there. So, and it's nice to see all of you here and here to learn, and that's primarily why we're here. So today, my part of the lecture is going to be talking about some emerging infections. And because of time, I couldn't touch upon all the infections that we've been hearing about, and I'm sure a lot of you have questions about things I won't be talking about, which I'm happy to talk about after the lecture. But I'm going to touch upon three or four things that I think we most definitely need to know and have been up and coming more recently. Okay, so the first topic we're going to talk about is, of course, MRSA, the very popular MRSA. And as many of you who were lucky enough to hear Dr. Diekman's lecture last week, there's been a lot of stuff in the media about MRSA. And a lot of the things I'm going to talk about today will touch upon that, and also in a way to quell some of the fears we've been having about MRSA as well. But just a little bit of history. This first actually came up in the 1960s. Of course, after we brought in methicillin, as usual, things happen in medicine. We overuse it, and then the bugs develop resistance. And that's basically why we evolved and had MRSA, methicillin resistant Staph aureus, which is what MRSA is short for. In the beginning of the 1960s, MRSA was primarily focusing in the hospital population, which are people that were generally chronically ill, had chronic indwelling catheters, people who were dialysis patients, patients who generally were sick. And these are the people that generally contracted hospital-acquired MRSA. And then we started noticing in the 90s that all of a sudden we started seeing them in healthy, normal people. And that was the question was, now, has this evolved into a superbug that now we're going to see attacking people who are perfectly healthy, and did, in fact, cause quite a scare? So, in fact, what is the difference between the two, and what should we be worried about? So, Staph aureus is actually among all of us. We actually all, a lot of us have it in the population. Almost half of the population have Staph aureus, either in their axilla, the rectum, the groin, and more commonly in their nose, the anterior nares. Now, of all the people that have Staph aureus, about 3% are methicillin resistant, the ones that we worry about. So there is a small population that are colonized, basically harbor the organism in their nose, their axilla, the rectum, and don't know it and are not having any clinical symptoms from this. These are the people that essentially are ones who are at risk for developing an infection if it becomes a skin infection, are also the people you have to be worried about of spreading it to the community. So only about 1 to 3% of the people are MRSA colonized, but are usually the target culprits for a lot of the infections that we see in the community. The difference between hospital-acquired and community-acquired is, this is just the only lecture, the only slide that'll go into a little bit of genetic makeup, but essentially hospital-acquired, has what they we call SEC, MEC types 1, 2, and 3 genes. All it means is that they have more of this gene than the community acquired, which basically lets the hospital-acquired variant have more resistance to more antibiotics. That's really the only difference. They have more of the bad gene, more mutations that have allowed them to evolve into a bug that has more resistance. That's the main difference. The other difference is that the community-acquired MRSA has another special gene that makes it predisposed to skin and soft tissue infections, which is why with community-acquired MRSA, we commonly see it clinically manifested as soft tissue infections. So which one should we worry about? They look like spider bites. In fact, anyone who comes into the ER complaining of, you know, doc, I think I got a spider bite, and they nowhere live in an area, they should worry about having spiders. We automatically worry about MRSA. They look just like spider bites. Up to 75% of emergency rooms have reported that their infections or soft tissue infections, abscesses, are MRSA positive. Sometimes, but very, very rarely, community-acquired MRSA can evolve into some more life-threatening diseases, necrotizing pneumonia, necrotizing fasciitis, or flesh-eating bacteria, as you all know. And basically, myositis, sepsis, if you don't know what these mean, basically they're all bad, just really bad stuff. But they're low in frequency. We don't see them commonly. But these are the cases we hear about in the news as the killers, the super bug. In fact, there's only been one study down in UCLA Harborview where they actually had about 14 patients who were MRSA positive for the skin-eating bacteria or the necrotizing fasciitis. And this was a study back done many, many years ago, and this is over many, many years. So still low in frequency. The only people that have to worry about it are us. We have to think about it when people come in with this and treat them and cover them for it, but this is not something that should make you fearful of the bacteria. It's most commonly going to be the spider bites, okay? And what are we worried about? Basically, it looks just like this. This is on somebody's abdomen. Looks like a little bite with a little bit of pus and some blood. That's basically what it looks like. Some more pictures. Basically, small little bites or lesions on your skin. Sometimes this is a picture of a 10-year-old girl that has a lesion in her anterior or her the front of her nose, entry of her nose, that's draining a little pus. These are the lesions which are almost 80% positive for MRSA. The only thing we have to worry about is making sure we cover for the organism. The bacteria that you'll get from the emergency room or your regular doctor for a regular abscess that gets drained or treated for is not going to cover MRSA. What's the worst that can happen? It doesn't get better. And then you come back, hopefully. And then we basically at that time culture and identify the organism. So the people that really have to worry about is us. What you have to worry about is if you have these little bites or lesions on the skin, don't try to pop them on your own. Don't try to treat them with hydrogen peroxide or all the other things that people do. Go to your doctor, go to the emergency room, and get treated with antibiotics. That's really all you need to do. Okay, so who are the people that really have to worry about this? Kids, soldiers, prisoners, athletes, IV drug users, and these ethnic populations. What's common among these people? What's sort of a common theme among all these groups of people? A lot of people in close quarters. They're all close, okay? So this is what tipped off, that it is more common among people who live in close quarters. What it is, that there is some belief that it's passed from skin to skin. Essentially all it means. People who live in close quarters are higher risk. That's all it means. Okay. How ubiquitous is it? How common is it for you to pick up MRSA? Okay. So there was a study actually done that looked at all the different sort of metals that we see in the community. And for instance, in copper, maybe about an hour and a half where it lives on the surface. In brass, maybe up to like between 4 and 5 hours. Stainless steel, about 6 hours or even longer. In fact, they found that MRSA can live on surfaces for up to 96 hours. And what's in most of our hospitals? Unfortunately, there we go. And probably most of our homes and our kitchens and so forth. So it does live a long time outside the body because unlike a virus, it can live and replicate on its own in the right environments. What's special about stainless steel over brass or copper? I'm not an engineer. I really don't know what's so special about stainless steel. But for some reason, it can thrive in that environment and can live at the 96 years. So it can be everywhere. And that's why we kind of have to know about this. What can you do? What can you do, especially if you have somebody in the family or you know somebody that has MRSA, is being treated for MRSA? Essentially, cover your wounds. This is absolutely the most important thing you can do. With anything that we've ever done in history, this has been the biggest benefit and the biggest impact on public health as a whole. Washing your hands, okay? And this is not just putting it under cold water, drying your hands, and you're done. This is a good couple of minutes under hot, warming, running water with soap, or if you have the sanitizer that you've all heard about in the media as well, which is in our hospitals, which is actually just a waterless sanitizer that Purell makes, that kills about 99% of the germs. And MRSA is sensitive to that Purell sanitizer. So that's also okay to use as well. Bathe regularly, especially if you have somebody in your family that has a lesion. Avoid sharing any items and then clean sports equipment. This is all essentially common sense. You have somebody with a wound, make sure they keep it covered, keep them separate, don't share their items, don't share their eating utensils. Pretty common sense. That's all you really need to do, and that's all really you can do. So how do we treat it? Well, you come to the ER or you go to your doctor. You see a lesion that looks like a spider bite, see your doctor, come to the ER, we'll take care of it. It's basically, there's a couple of antibiotics that we can give you. They're all oral. You don't need to come in. You don't need to be admitted. If you think it has to be lanced, we'll do it. You don't do it at home. We'll do it, okay? We'll do it, and then we'll go ahead and culture it for you, and we'll start you antibiotics, and then if all goes well, you'll be just fine. There are a few people that come in that have been waiting a while and have let things fester for a while and get sicker and sicker or have done things to try to treat themselves, or a lot of people who don't have access to health care, which is, you know, usually the most common problem in our population at SFGH, is that they may have to come in for IV antibiotics. But for the most part, the common problems are going to be soft tissue lesions. Rarely you'll have the life-threatening diseases. What you can do is get medical attention sooner than later so we can treat you as an outpatient and you're done. If it gets more serious, we bring you in. But really, for the most part, don't try to play doctor at home. Let us do the job for you, and we'll make sure we cover for the bugs that we're seeing in our community. And up to 80% of these abscesses are MRSA. So we'll treat them. We still have antibiotics that they're sensitive to, so we're still okay. All right? All right, what about the future? Now, I told you there was about that 1% to 3% of the population that have MRSA, right? The people who are the colonizers. What do we do about these people? We can't just throw them into a room and keep them there their whole lives, right? We have to live and breathe among us. What do we do about these people? Do we decolonize them? Do we try to get rid of the MRSA that's living in their nose, their rectum, their axilla, their groin? What do we do? So studies have used and looked at all kinds of disinfectants, and they've shown that nothing works. It's not worth the money. And if these people present clinically or infect other people clinically, we treat the disease. There's no prevention or prophylaxis for colonizers. So if you know you're a colonizer, don't worry about it. Let it be. Just be known that you're a colonizer. Be careful around people who are immunocompromised, children, pregnant women, that sort of thing. And if you do develop an infection, you come and see us. There has been no benefit to decolonize these people who are colonized MRSA on their skin. Any hope for a vaccine? They're probably thinking it's probably not going to be effective, and they're not putting any money into the research for this. So time will tell what's going to happen. But right now, nothing to worry about. Take all the precautions, and we have stuff out there that can still treat this. All right, now, the flu. How many here have had the flu? Large. How many of you have had the flu, had the vaccine? Okay, smaller portion of you. Okay, all right. So why is the flu important? Well, because it's actually pretty common, and it actually, I didn't know, the numbers are pretty big for deaths for the flu. This is in the U.S. So up to 20% of people get the flu. 36,000 people actually die from this. Who are these people? These are generally people who are over 65 and kids under 2. Why are these two populations affected? Because their immune systems are not as strong, and they usually have other sort of comorbidities, other diseases that make them more prone to get sick. That's always a population we worry about, the very young and the very old. Okay? So over 200,000 people come and get admitted to the hospital for flu-like symptoms. We think flu-like, take care of it, go home, get some rest, and that's fine, you'll get over it. That's all well and good, but people really get sick from the flu. And why do we gotta worry about it? Because the flu spreads to other people. And soon enough, they start calling in sick to work. They can't take care of their kids. They can't take care of their homes. They get sick. They spread to everyone else, and it's a nuisance. It's just a nuisance. And this is something that we can actually prevent. And these are people that we have to worry most about. These people absolutely have to think of getting a flu vaccine every single year. These are the people that get sick. So just a little bit of history. The pandemic, some of you might have read about this in your history book. Some of you might even have lived through some of them. Really bad. This was the worst. This was over 50 million people dead in 6 months worldwide. 500,000 in the U.S. alone. This was just the flu, the worst. Then it got a little better. We went from 50 million to 1.5 million to 1 million. So what happened between here and here, you think? What do you think happened? The vaccine and antibiotics, exactly. People were getting treated for complications of the flu. And what happens when you get really sick, your immune system is down, you get prone to other bacterial infections in the community that you normally would be able to fight off, but now you're more prone to them. And you get treated with antibiotics. Somebody mentioned antibiotics, and they got better. So antibiotics came around this time, and then all of a sudden now the number of people that got sick went down dramatically. But it can be bad in of itself. So how's it spread? Very easily. Droplets, people cough, they sneeze, it's spread to you, you've got it, okay? And also, if you touch stuff that they touch, they can get it as well. The worst part about it is that you can be contagious before you even know you have it, okay? So a day or two before you even know you're going to be sick, you're contagious. Up until 5 days after you think you're fine, you can still be contagious. And some kids can be sick and contagious up to 7 days after they're feeling better. So sometimes you don't even know it, and you're passing it on. What are the symptoms? All of us know, right? Fever, headache, sore throat. You know, your body feels like it's been hit by a truck. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. You feel like crap. Just crap. There's no other word for it. So what about the vaccine that we have? So, and the question always is, well, how do they pick the vaccine? How do you know that the shot you're getting is going to cover this train that's going to come during your year? So what happens is that they actually have this really nice group of these centers. They call it the National Influenza Centers. These are basically 122 centers that have been picked by the WHO that are worldwide. They're essentially, it's like a think tank about putting together, basically getting viruses from people who were sick that year, isolating the virus, and then basically making a vaccine that closely resembles the virus that was infecting the people the year before. So what, in fact, you're getting is a vaccine that's most effective against the virus that was affecting people the year before. So why does it work so well for the next year? So what they do is they try to predict mutation-wise, what's going to happen to the virus, and then they try to make the virus based on that selective thinking about what could happen, and that's how they make the vaccine. Once they know what the magic formula is, it takes 6 months to make. And then once it's out, it's ready to use. So, and how they decide how good it is what they call the match, okay? And so 2004 was a bad year. Apparently the match was only 60%. A good match is about 80 or 90%. And that's how they can tell whether they hit the jackpot or not. They have a couple of misses, but they're usually about 80 or 90% right. And how what the vaccine is comprised of is a neuraminidase and the hemagglutinin, another little biology slide that we're not going to go into too much. But these are the two proteins that basically define the influenza A virus. There's like 16 types of this and 9 types of this. And so as a combination of the two means there's just a lot of variants, right? And there's obviously some that make it out that can cause endemics and other ones that basically wither out and we never hear about again. So the vaccine essentially is made up of these two protein coats, which basically help the virus replicate and also help the virus glom onto a target cell where it feeds off of. Remember, a virus has to get into a host cell to survive. It can't survive on its own. So those are the two proteins we target in the vaccines. The vaccines basically decide which of the two, the combination of two, we need to make. There are two types of vaccines that we have. There is the trivalent influenza vaccine, which is a shot that many of us have had. It's been available since the 40s. The new one that's actually been available since 2003 is actually an attenuated virus, which is actually just something it's like a nasal spray. Many of you or some of you might have actually had that. Have anyone tried the nasal spray at all? It's been available 2003, and they've shown that they're both equally effective, no shot. Okay? The problem is that the people that can only get the weakened virus are people who are healthy between 5 and 49. These are the people you're worried least about anyway, right? These are the people you worry, but it's the really young, the really old, and the really sick. And so they all get stuck with the shot. Sorry, there's nothing else left for them. They have to get the shot. But they're both equally effective, and if you're young and you're healthy and you just don't want to get the flu, then the option is you can get the spray. Okay, and it's available, and it's there, and most insurances do cover it, and it works just as well. When do you worry about getting the flu vaccine? Well, usually people say October, November before the flu season starts, but now our flu season is extending out into May. So actually you'll find that doctors will actually recommend you get vaccines even into January, February to hit some of the peaks later on in early to late spring. So I would say just get it anytime. Doesn't matter. Ideally October to November, but if you're later into the winter, just get it if it's available. All right, so who are people that we need to worry about getting vaccinations? Basically, again, the young, the pregnant, people who are sick, people who live in nursing homes, anyone who lives with any of these people, and people who work in the hospitals or any healthcare facility. Basically, people who should not get this vaccination or think about it are people who have an allergy to chicken eggs, because it is actually the virus of the vaccine is actually synthesized and replicated in chick embryos. So people who are allergic to egg protein should not get the vaccine. If they've had any severe allergies in the past, that's common sense. They're not going to get another shot. And essentially, people are less than 6 months of age because their immune system is still actually still a little weak and underdeveloped, but they have antibodies from mom. So these are people you don't have to worry about getting the vaccine for. Okay, what about Tamiflu and Relenza? Anyone try these two drugs at all? Nobody? That's good. You know what? Because they only really reduce your illness by one day. They're expensive. They don't have a lot of huge effects on the longevity of the disease, but they are effective in preventing infection. But for the most part, they're just expensive drugs made by drug manufacturers to get rich. They don't make you any better, any faster by more than one day. And you have to start them within 2 days. Okay, but if you have people who can't get the shot for any reason, then this is an option they can use to prevent the infection. They have an allergy, or there's people who have had bad reactions to the vaccine before. They can actually take either one of these two for every day, though, of the flu season. It actually is very good in preventing the infection. So there is an option for people who can't get the shot or the vaccine. Okay. So this has been in the news a lot too, right? Heard about the bird flu? Thought we'd touch upon it a little bit. Okay, so the bird flu, how dangerous is it really? So actually, in the last couple of years, we've actually had about 340 cases worldwide of bird flu. 260 of them have actually died. These are human cases. All right, so those are the numbers we're looking at as of today. 340 worldwide, 260 died. Zero in the U.S. We don't have bird flu in the U.S. Okay? All right. So what happens? How do you know you got bird flu? Well, it looks just like the flu, right? Or the common cold. So it's really nonspecific. You won't know if you have the bird flu. And so essentially, you're not going to really know at all. But you know, you have a 60% chance of dying from this. You want to know if you have it. So we're going to talk a little bit about when you should be worried if you have the bird flu. But like I said, it's not a problem in the U.S. It's more of a problem for travelers. So who are the culprits? Ducks and shorebirds. Do people know what shorebirds are? I'm a city girl. I don't know anything about birds. Do you know what shorebirds are? Sandpiper. Who knows? All I know is that they're wild birds. And these are the people that harbor the avian flu bug. The good news is that they don't get sick from it. It's who they pass it on to. All right, so these wild birds are the culprits, and they go ahead and pass on their nastiness to all what we call the domestic animals, which are the more sheltered animals, like the chickens we hear about, the ducks and the turkeys that you see on the farms. The people who are not exposed to the wild pathogens are people that are more prone to developing infection. So what happens is that these wild birds then they drop their feces, or they might, if they have any of the symptoms, they sort of sneeze sneeze or any of their secretions pass on to the domestic animals, these people are the ones that die. These animals, sorry, are the ones that die. They're the ones that get sick. And then how do we get it? We basically get it from slaughtering, defeathering, eating, consuming, any of these. That's how we get it. Okay, because all bodily fluids are considered infections. Now, this actually is very, very rare. So we know it goes from the wild birds to the domestic animals, like the turkeys and the chickens and the ducks. The animal to the human transmission only happens if you involve yourself in high-risk behavior, eating them, defeathering them, slaughtering them. What happens if you have it? What's the likelihood of you passing it on to someone else that's close to you? The only reports they've had of human-to-human transmission are usually small clusters of families. So it does exist. It's not zero. There are a few cases of very close contacts of family members who can pass it on to each other with significant fluid transmission or like an oral to fecal route. But for the most part, it's still not something that has been a very much concern to the, for instance, like the CDC or to the San Francisco Department of Public Health, because it's still rather rare. But there have been some human-to-human transmissions, which is why we need to worry a little bit about bird flu becoming something bigger than it is. The treatment, well, the thing is that Tamiflu, surprisingly, useless for influenza, but actually very good for the one that kills us, and that's for bird flu. The problem is that they're not letting us have it for this right now. First of all, there hasn't been any U.S. cases, but more importantly, the WHO is stockpiling it. So in case there's a pandemic, then they're going to have the medication to give to people who have the disease. So they're only restricting it to people who actually have the disease, but it's been shown to be effective, but we don't have access to it to that large amount in case of a pandemic. It has to be distributed by the Department of Public Health. Right now, the WHO has stockpiled it. Vaccine for avian flu, probably something that's on the horizon. They do give the vaccine to the birds that have been affected. If you have ducks or turkeys or chickens and you're a farmer and they've been exposed to the avian flu, there have been vaccines for those animals to prevent the infection, but the vaccine has not been made available for humans. Prevention, basically common sense. There we go. There are the wash hands again. Okay, wash your hands. And if you're going to travel for areas that are endemic for bird flu, and these are commonly areas like Indonesia, China, and Thailand, be sure you check with the CDC to make sure that you pay attention to travel advisory and what to do in these countries when you actually travel. And then, of course, obviously, do not eat undercooked poultry. I mean, these are just common sense things that we have to remind ourselves. Basically, bird flu, not a problem in the U.S., more of a problem for travelers. If you're going to travel to a place that has bird flu, be sure you take the precautions. Don't go visiting farm animals and petting them or eating undercooked poultry. Just stick to the tourist sites, okay? Stick to the book. No need to venture off. Yes. Okay, the question is, how do you know if they don't undercook the poultry? Well, the way I know is if it's pink, you don't eat it. I just look at it. If it's pink or bleeding, don't eat it. Yeah, that's the only way that I know. I mean, if you're going to ask the people at the restaurant if they've cooked their poultry enough, what are they going to tell you? Of course. So what does this mean for us? Is this actually true? So what we had talked about, this is what we worried about. We talked about those epidemics, the flu killing off millions and millions and millions of people. What will it take for the bird flu to do the same thing? So basically, a pandemic is basically an epidemic that's really wide-ranging, spreads across continents. That's the only difference between an epidemic and a pandemic. People are worried about a pandemic. So what it'll take? A pandemic will basically involve an emergence of a disease that's new to the population. Well, bird flu is new to the population. It's an agent that'll infect humans, causing serious illness. Well, 60% death rate's pretty serious, so we should probably take it seriously. Agent spreads easily and sustainably among humans. So I've told you that there have been a few reports of clustering of families that have spread it to one another, but it's not that easy. So bird flu has actually got these two down. This is the last remaining step that it needs to accomplish. Then we got to worry about a pandemic. And what will it take to get to that last step? Basically, a merging of the bird flu strain with a human strain of the flu. They come together. This is your superbug, not MRSA. this is going to be the superbug that's going to kill millions of people. Now, knowing that, and of course everybody is on board that that needs to happen. There are surveillance teams. There are people who are stockpiling drugs to help. There are ways and mechanisms in place to prevent this from happening. But it's still, the possibility there exists that all it takes is this train, you've got a pandemic, because then you've met all those three criteria. And this is why this is something we have to worry about. Right now, not a problem, but could potentially be a very big problem very quickly. And that's why you have to take the precautions that I talked about before, but not a whole lot that we can do in the meantime. So what does this mean? We all become vegetarians. That's basically my lesson of that story. All right. Last thing we're going to talk about is the measles. We've heard a little bit about it in the community. It comes back. You know, we think we got it licked, and it comes back and bites us in the ass and somehow just always keeps showing its ugly head. So why do we have to worry about it? Because it's bad, basically. So 30 million cases a year, okay? Almost a million people die from this, but more than half of them are in Africa. And the reason that people think that more people are dying from Africa is just malnutrition. They're just immunocompromised. They don't have the basic sustenance to keep up their health. And that's why they get more affected from measles. So not a huge problem in the U.S., more of a problem in other continents, but essentially high death rate. Okay? Now, why do we worry about it now? Because it's been in the news again in the news. And basically what we have found is that there have been 64 U.S. cases in this year, basically from January to April so far. One of those cases was in somebody that was vaccinated, okay? There was about 14 cases in children that are too young to be vaccinated, so they were susceptible. The remaining 40 cases were people who chose not to get vaccinated. That's the population of people that we have to educate vigorously. You must absolutely get the vaccine. This has bad repercussions, the side effects from the vaccine. I'm not going to get on a podium about MMR and autism because that's not my job tonight. But there has been a lot of controversy about the measles vaccine and its association with autism. And there's been a lot of people out there not getting the vaccination for that reason. And these are the people that are getting the measles. In San Francisco, there's usually a background caseload of 0 to 3. We've had one case this year so far from an individual that traveled to India, picked up the measles, brought it back, and spread it to some people in his family. But that's been the only case so far in San Francisco. Symptoms, again, kind of nonspecific. You just feel like crap, right? Again, this could be anything, all right? So still, again, the fevers are usually higher, though. And people can oftentimes develop pink eye. So high fever and pink eye, and you know you're susceptible to getting measles, and so you got to worry about having it in that case. But why do we have to worry about measles in general? Just a picture of the rash. It's kind of like a bumpy red rash. This is a close-up, okay? And it starts usually from the head and goes down the neck to the trunk and then out to the arms and to the legs. Okay, but it looks like it's usually in the rash and measles just because it's more common in kids and the elderly. That's why we'll see a lot more kids come in looking like this. But that's essentially the classic measles rash. You may also actually in the mouth, if you can see it good enough, are these little white splotches. They look like salt pieces. Those are called coplic spots. That's pathognomonic, characteristic, basically the definition of measles. If you have that, you've got the measles. All right, so why do we got to worry about it? Well, a couple people, 1 in 10, 10%, that's not low, can develop ear infections. A small proportion can have permanent hearing loss from them. 1 in 1,000, not a whole lot, can actually get inflammation of the brain called encephalitis. We've all heard about encephalitis. They can actually develop that. And then actually 1 in 1,000 can actually die from measles. Who would ever figured you can die from measles? But you can. And you can get really sick from it as well. The other problem with measles, highly, 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 highly contagious, and you may not even know you have it, okay? You actually are contagious for about 4 days before the rash till 4 days after the rash. It's just like influenza. You don't know when you have it, and you're spreading the germs to everyone else, okay? And the droplets can remain active after they're in the air and on surfaces for 2 hours. Okay, so you got to worry about them being out in the environment as well. There's no treatment for measles. Measles, actually, if you've known you've been exposed, let's say you've been traveling, you've been exposed, you can actually get the vaccine for up to 3 days after exposure, and it will prevent the illness. And basically, the only treatment for measles is to prevent it from happening, and that's to vaccinate. Just a couple words about vaccination. Vaccination has been very, very successful. These are the group of people that you want to think about getting vaccinated, 12 to 15 months, and then you get the second shot at 4 to 6 years. One shot gives you about 95% protection. The second shot will boost you up to 99%. So you do want to get the two shots. Adults born after 1956, adults born before 1956, they don't worry about getting the vaccine because they've been exposed enough to it in the community. They've developed a wild immunity to it. So they think that these people don't even need to have the measles vaccine. They have it already in their body, and their body's fighting it. They don't need the antibodies for this. Healthcare workers, obviously, people who should not get it because it's a live, attenuated virus. Pregnant people and immunocompromised. Any live attenuated virus, pregnant women, people who are sick, and kids that are very young should not get the vaccine. That's just basically a basic blanket rule. If it's a killed vaccine, everyone can get it. Even pregnant women, even breastfeeding women can get it. It won't pass on to the fetus. But anything that's live, attenuated, weakened, these people should avoid getting any of those vaccines. And that's what the MMR vaccine is. Okay, so how good are we worldwide with the measles vaccination? Well, not that. We're okay. Bolivia, you know, it's not where we want it to be. Africa is just terrible. I mean, they're not meeting their goals, but they've got other problems to worry about right now. So they're just not meeting their goals. India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Thailand are areas that could actually use some improvement. Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, all these areas can use some improvement. Why we got to worry about? You know, we're clean and pristine. I was actually surprised that UK and France and Italy actually are not, you know, above 90% as well. So much for socialized medicine, right? Another argument against it. So this, what happens is that people who are traveling to these higher endemic areas and bringing it back to our country, and then what happens is that you may harbor the organism, and if you're vaccinated, you're not going to get symptoms. Because it's so highly contagious, you bring it back and you spread it to people who are unvaccinated, you've got a problem. So this is why we're preaching about vaccination to everybody and why it's so important. Okay. Any questions before we go on to Dr. Smolin at all? Yes. We had a question here about Tamiflu, how long it lasts, what's the shelf life. So they've actually, most shelf lives for drugs are much longer than what they put in the box. And so the Tamiflu shelf life for now, it's anywhere from 5 to 10 years. And so they will need to upgrade the Tamiflu regimen as the virus changes. But for now, they still can keep them and stockpile it for that many years. A question back there? Yeah. Yeah, so actually somebody brought in, so what was your name, gentlemen, sir? Steve. Steve brought in the article from the San Francisco Chronicle about C. diff. Have any of you seen this or heard about C. diff? So the C. diff, it is fecal oral route, and it's most commonly originates in people who get antibiotics that harbor the C. diff organism. So, and you know, it used to be a kind of a hospital problem that, you know, people are antibiotics, they come in with bloody diarrhea, we check for C. diff and we treat them. But now what's gotten the media attention is there have been so many other problems with this in the community, and now the public's getting more aware of this. But initially started as a hospital problem from overuse of antibiotics. Like most of the problems we get in the community now and resistance, now we're having problems again with antibiotic overuse. That's a good question, but you will see more about this in the news. Yes?
Say something about encephalitis.
Mm-hmm.
Approximately how many people with measles wind up with encephalitis and why?
Yeah, well, the numbers are like 1 in 1,000. And why do we get encephalitis from measles? Primarily, because the virus actually, what happens is that the virus, when it infects you, stays mostly in your bloodstream and in the outside of the brain. But once it passes what we call the blood-brain barrier, it can then cause the same infection you would have on the outside, you now have in your brain. Once it passes that barrier, then you have what you call encephalitis, meningitis, and you have a whole host of other problems as well. But that's how essentially it makes that, it goes from just something that gives you cough, cold, flu symptoms to now something that's more life-threatening. So it can happen. It's still rare, but it can happen. Yes?
What are the symptoms of that?
Of C. diff, basically really bad diarrhea that's bloody and bad belly pain. You can get some fevers with this as well, but you just have really bad, and it's really bloody diarrhea too. Yeah. So the question was, what's special about hospital-acquired MRSA that keeps it in the hospital and doesn't introduce it into the community? Hospital-acquired MRSA has basically the special component of having three genes that are in the bacteria that make it more resistant to more drugs. The reason why it's hospital-limited, because people in the hospital are sicker, they usually have more antibiotics, and therefore develop more resistance to more antibiotics. And that's why these bacteria thrive, because these are people who are on the most number of antibiotics and breed these organisms. Okay. Prone to community acquired? Yeah, well, you know, community acquired is like peanuts compared to hospital. Hospital acquired is like big guns. I mean, these people are sick. And hospital acquired MRSA needs to be treated very aggressively with very complicated antibiotic regimen. So community acquired MRSA is really basically small compared to the problem that hospital acquired MRSA can actually wreak. The question is, why can't hospital acquired MRSA patients get community acquired? So community acquired is just a new sort of evolving mutation version that is resistant to fewer antibiotics, but has developed a special gene that makes it more prone to soft tissue infections as opposed to hospital-acquired. So they're just a mutated form of the hospital-acquired MRSA. We'll take one more question. We need to move on. Go ahead. Right. So the question was, are providers still able to get Tamiflu to give to people who can't get the shot? And yes. It's not like when there was an anthrax scare and you couldn't get Cipro it's not sort of coveted into that regard. But people who are allergic to the vaccine absolutely should be on Tamiflu every day until the flu season is over. Especially people who are especially prone to get sick. Okay, so moving along, just for time purposes, I'm happy to answer more questions after we're done here for the evening. So Dr. Smolin actually is a California native, born in L.A., but actually went to UC Berkeley. And then he went to medical school at Albert Einstein, where he got his medical degree, and did his emergency medicine training back in my stomping grounds in New York City at my rival residency, which was NYU Bellevue. So he was in the heart of where all the action was going on with 9/11 and also the anthrax scare, which hopefully he'll touch upon tonight as well. He then came back to San Francisco, did a toxicology fellowship at our very own UCSF, and is now the assistant director of the San Francisco Poison Control Center. He's written numerous papers and has done numerous presentations at talks about toxicology-related topics. But today he's going to narrow his talk to things that are sort of agents of bioterrorism, especially since they have some relevance to what we heard in the media and also what's happened in the recent past as well. So, Dr. Smolin, thank you for coming.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Malini. It is true I am a native Californian from Los Angeles, but don't hold that against me. I'm a reformed Los Angeles person. And it is my pleasure to be here tonight to talk to you about the uplifting topic of bioterrorism. So, again, in the interest of time, it would be really impossible in a half-hour lecture for me to talk about everything that relates to bioterrorism. So basically what I'm going to do is talk a little bit, give you a little bit of a definition. What are we talking about when we're talking about bioterrorism? And then I'm going to move on and talk about some of the characteristics of the agents that make an ideal bioterrorism agent. So I'm going to talk about some of the characteristics of agents that make them ideal bioterrorism agents. And then finally, I'm going to just delve into two specific agents, those being anthrax and botulism, and talk a little bit about those in depth. And then hopefully I'll have some time to take your questions at the end. So let's see if I can operate this. So, what is bioterrorism? Just a brief definition. If you look up on the CDC website, it is the deliberate release of a virus, a bacteria, or some other germ or agent used to cause illness or death in people, animals, or plants. Okay? Why does a terrorist want to use a biologic agent? What's in it for the terrorist? Well, the attractive part to the terrorist for using a biologic agent is, one, they can be extraordinarily difficult to detect, okay? And I'll show you why that is with the example of anthrax. And the other thing is that there is often a delay between the time of exposure to the time that the physician or the community realizes that they've been exposed to the agent. And that delay actually sort of maximizes the potential harm of any particular agent. And so it's that delay that really becomes important. So if I was Dr. Evil, okay, and I wanted to make the ideal bioterrorism agent, okay, what exactly would I be looking for? Okay, well, one, I would be looking for an agent that can easily be delivered. If I've got to run around with a syringe and inject you with some kind of agent to get you sick, that's not a very good bioterrorism agent. Okay, it's got to be something that can be very easily delivered. And usually that's something that's an aerosol, something that can just be put into the air or something that can be put into our food or the water supply that we wouldn't know about that could then be distributed to large numbers of people. Secondly, you want something that's going to have high lethality, okay? If it's just something that is going to be, it's going to infect a bunch of people but just maybe cause some diarrhea and then they're going to get better, well, that's not a great agent, okay? I want something, if I'm Dr. Evil, that's going to kill people, that's going to have a high rate of lethality. The other important thing is that it has to maintain its viability and infectivity in the environment. And the next slide, I'll talk to a little bit more about that. But in other words, you know, there's all kinds of things in our environment that destroy bugs, okay? UV light, heat, etc. And so an ideal agent has to be able to survive that. And then finally, ideally, if you're going to be manufacturing and distributing this agent to other people, you yourself don't want to really be affected by it. So ideally, that agent will have a vaccine or some prophylaxis that you can take so that you're not affected. Okay? So, environmental constraints. Okay? Like I said, UV light kills a lot of things. Okay? Wind spreads agents around. So if you're going to use an aerosol, it's going to take a lot of logistics to make sure, especially in a city like San Francisco where the wind is always crazy, where is that agent going to go? Is it going to go to the right place that you want it to go to affect the maximum number of people? Temperature, heat. Heat inactivates many agents. And so is the pasteurization process, for instance, of milk or whatever, if you're trying to poison the juice supply or something like that, is that going to kill your agent? Because if it is, then you're not going to be able to use it as a bioterrorist agent. And then finally, desiccation, which is just drying out of things. So when things get dry, they often become inactivated, and then they can't grow anymore. Okay, so that's another limitation and another thing that you have to take into consideration when you're thinking about making a biological weapon or using bioterrorism. This, by the way, is a picture that my wife took when she went to Madagascar last year of a bubo, which is caused by bubonic plague. Madagascar has one of the highest rates of this disease in the world, and so that's why she was there studying it for the CDC. And this is one of the agents that is talked about as a potential bioterrorism agent. So here's the list, okay? Here are the agents that you will hear about the most, okay, as far as, you know, what's a potential biological agent that will be used in a terrorist attack, okay? Anthrax, I'm going to talk about a little bit, and we've all heard about it, okay? The parentheses are the actual organisms that cause the disease, okay? Smallpox is another one that is commonly talked about. It's a virus. Plague, okay, we just talked about that. Bubonic plague, that's a bacteria. Tularemia, that's another bacteria that causes disease. Botulism, I'm going to talk a little bit about botulism. Brucellosis is another bacterial disease that you may have heard about. And then the viral hemorrhagic fevers, that's the Dustin Hoffman movie, Outbreak, where everyone's bleeding out of their eyes and everything because they've got Ebola virus, okay? So let me take you back to October 6, 2001. Did this die? Okay, October 6, 2001. This is the New York Times. This was an article that appeared in the New York Times. Florida man dies of rare form of anthrax. A 63-year-old Florida man, he had previously been hospitalized with pulmonary anthrax and died on Tuesday. The CDC says that the case seemed to have been an isolated one with natural causes. Okay. Still, because of now routine precaution during time of extreme concern, what time of extreme concern was this? This was 9/11, just post 9/11. They're considering the possibility that it was a result of a terrorist attack. This case was eventually published later on in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the preeminent journal for doctors, essentially. Index case of fatal inhalational anthrax due to bioterrorism in the United States. What happened in this case? Okay. On October 2nd, 2001, a 63-year-old man, he comes into the emergency department. What's he complaining of? He had some fever, he had some vomiting, a little bit of confusion that was going on for about 4 days. He was disoriented. He wasn't really able to provide any medical history to the doctors who were taking care of him. What was the working diagnosis? It was meningitis. Meningitis is an infection of the fluid that surrounds your brain and your spinal cord. And someone who presents like this, this can be a relatively common presentation in the emergency department, and this is what everyone would probably be thinking, every physician would be thinking, this is probably meningitis. So what do you do for a patient who has meningitis? You give them antibiotics that will hopefully affect the organism that may be involved, and you do a spinal tap. Okay, so you stick a needle in the spine, pull out some fluid, and what do you do with that fluid? You send it to the laboratory, and you look at it under the microscope. Okay, and so they sent this fluid to the laboratory, and they looked at it under the microscope, and here you can see that what they saw were gram-positive bacilli. All gram-positive means is that it shows up as this purple color on a gram stain. So there's two different types of cells that you can see here. There's these big ones with little like purple inside of them like this. Those are white blood cells. Those aren't supposed to be in your CSF, in the fluid around your spinal cord. Those indicate that there's an infection and that there's cells in your body that are trying to fight off the infection. And then you see these little rod-like things that look like, I don't know, maybe like railroad cars or something like that. And those are the gram-positive organisms. And this was the first clue that something was up, something's awry, because this organism is not a common organism that causes meningitis, okay? If you look, all I want you to get out of this slide is these are common organisms that cause meningitis. So these are all the organisms right here that are commonly involved in run-of-the-mill meningitis. And these are their physical characteristics, what they look like when you put them under a microscope and you look for them. And none of them look like gram-positive bacilli. Okay, so what's going on here? This is not the usual organism. So they thought and suspected that maybe something unusual was going on here. This is a normal chest x-ray here. This is the chest x-ray of the patient when he was admitted to the hospital. The difference between these two is, well, number one, this patient actually has a breathing tube going down into their lungs. But here they have a very narrow mediastinum. This is called the mediastinum, and it's very narrow. Here it's very wide. It's going from right here all the way to over here. Okay, but there's no real infection in the lungs. Okay, this is the second clue, a chest x-ray showing widened mediastinum. That was a clue that something else was going on here, that this was an unusual infection that was going on in this character. And then, so they started to think, well, maybe this is an anthrax infection. Maybe we're seeing a case of anthrax. So what did they do? This is what happened to the patient. He was started on high-dose penicillin, which treats anthrax. Within hours, he developed some seizures, and he was intubated. That means they put a breathing tube down him because he couldn't breathe anymore on his own. On the second day, he developed low blood pressure. His kidneys went into failure, essentially. On the third day, his heart basically stopped, and he died. So they did an autopsy on him, which was consistent with anthrax infection, and this was the first case of inhalational anthrax reported in the U.S. since 1978. Okay. This anthrax is a disease that exists. I mean, I'll show you a slide later on, like, you know, where do you see anthrax? It's in the soil. It's a common bug. But you don't see it in the general population. You see it in patients who work with animals usually. Okay? What about this guy? What was going on with this guy? Well, you know, what further history were they able to obtain about this man? Well, it turns out that he worked as a photo editor for a tabloid newspaper. And he spent most of his days reviewing photographs that would be sent in through the mail or through email. And his coworkers noticed that about 8 days, now keep that in mind, 8 days before his illness, okay, he had been closely examining a suspicious letter that contained some powder. So this is what we were talking about, those ideal agents, bioterrorism agents, okay? There's a delay, okay? There's a period from the exposure to the time that it's discovered where more people could be exposed. And that's the whole idea behind using why terrorists would want to use these agents, okay, because of this delay. And so he was noted to have opened the suspicious package and closely examined it. They went to his workstation. They found anthrax spores in his computer. And then exposure was confirmed in asymptomatic coworkers. So not everyone who's exposed to anthrax is going to get it, okay? There are people who could just be exposed and be asymptomatic, you know, just not get a full infection of anthrax. And so they went and they tested some of his coworkers, and they had also been exposed, but they didn't develop the disease. Okay. What is inhalational anthrax? It's caused by spores of Bacillus anthracis. Like I said, it's present in the soil. Again, these are the properties that you need to have to be a good bioterrorism agent. You have to be resistant to drying, to heat, to UV light, to radiation, and many disinfectants. Okay, very hard to kill it. When do you get disease? If you inhale the spores, that's when you get pulmonary anthrax. Okay, incubation period, 1 to 6 days. You have an initial phase of a mild fever, some fatigue, some body aches. Maybe you get a cough and some chest pain. Maybe it just feels kind of like the flu initially. And then 2 to 3 days later, a second phase develops where you look like this guy. Okay, you basically end up having low blood pressure, you get seizures, and you end up having shock, and you die within 24 to 36 hours. Okay. This was another interesting case that was going on at the same time in New York. A 7-month-old male comes into the emergency department. He has 2 days of left arm swelling. Okay. A 2-centimeter open sore with some surrounding redness is seen, okay, on his left arm. It oozed some clear yellow fluid. This sounds a little like Malini's spider bite, right? Or MRSA, right? The initial diagnosis is that of a brown recluse spider bite, okay? The patient's treated with some antibiotics. Here's a picture of what the arm looked like, okay? And then this is an MRI that was done, so it's basically like a cross-section of this baby's arm, and all it's really showing is subcutaneous swelling, subcutaneous tissue swelling in and around this site. Okay. Here's 2 pictures, okay? One of these pictures is cutaneous anthrax, and the other one is a brown recluse spider bite. Which one is which? Very difficult for a physician to tell which one is which, okay? They kind of look similar. They both have kind of a black center. Both have kind of a black center, some surrounding erythema, a little bit of surrounding erythema. This is part of the problem, okay? Very difficult with these bioterrorism agents. Difficult to make the diagnosis, okay? Difficult for physicians, you know, regular physicians to recognize what it is. This is cutaneous anthrax, and this is a brown recluse spider bite. Now, one of the interesting things is, I wouldn't be a toxicologist if I didn't put a huge picture of a spider up on the lecture, so I had to throw that in. This is a brown recluse spider. And this is where the brown recluse spider lives, okay? So again, Malini was talking about all these patients who come into San Francisco General and they say, I've got a spider bite, and they get diagnosed maybe with a brown recluse spider. There are no brown recluse spiders in California, okay? There are no brown recluse spiders in New York. Doesn't mean that there haven't been any cases of true brown recluse spider bites in New York or California, because sometimes they can hitch a ride on, you know, the U-Haul on the way out or something like that. But it's not common, okay? It's not a diagnosis that's common, okay? So that's a clue that, you know, maybe that's the wrong diagnosis. If you guys don't recognize, this is Times Square in New York City. What happened with this kid? 2 days prior to his presentation, he went to work with his mother. His mother works at a television network station in New York City. Anthrax, at the same time, was discovered at another network television area. And they did biopsies of this patient's arm, and it turned out to be cutaneous anthrax. So this is all going on at the same time. The pulmonary anthrax cases were going on, and now we started to see cutaneous cases of anthrax at the same time. These are the letters, the infamous letters that were sent to Senator Daschle and Leahy, and then to the editors of the New York Post and to Tom Brokaw at NBC TV that were suspected to contain anthrax. Cutaneous anthrax, this is the kind that's most often seen in the United States. 95% of all anthrax infections are of the cutaneous type. Now, inhalation was when you inhaled the spores. This is when the spores get into your body through a cut, okay? They basically get in through a cut or an abrasion. The skin lesions, you saw them. They're usually painless, so here's another clue. Painless itchy papule. Brown recluse spider bites are actually painful, okay? They're not painless, so another difference between the two. They usually, again, here's that delay, 3 to 5 days after exposure. So then you got to go back and trace where was this person 3 to 5 days ago and what could they have been in contact with. And usually what happens in the first 24 to 36 hours, you get this central necrosis. That just means the center turns black. And then it forms something called an eschar, which is basically a black center. Severe swelling can occur in some cases, but the good news is that the lesions resolve without complications in usually to 80-90% of cases. Okay. And then we all know kind of what happened from here. You know, there was all these articles, you know, another anthrax found in the NBC News aide. Bronx woman is the fourth to die from anthrax. U.S. Says that thousands of letters may have had anthrax traces. And when it was all said and done, a total of 22 cases were reported. There were 10 that were inhalational, 12 cutaneous, and 5 deaths. They were all in the inhalational group. Okay. This was actually important because prior to this outbreak of anthrax, it was thought that inhalational anthrax was 90% mortality. Okay, but in actuality, this is based on data stretching back very far because we don't see this infection very often. And 5 of the 10 actually survived. And so I think that with the better care that we have these days, better supportive care, recognition, antibiotics, etc., you know, this is a 50% mortality rate, which is still extraordinarily high, but much better than 90%. And this investigation is still going on. We still don't know who is responsible, who did this. So this is probably the first case of successful bioterrorism within the United States. Again, to keep in mind as a perspective, many people were exposed probably, but only 22 cases actually occurred. Okay, so it gives you kind of an idea of how difficult is it to actually, affect many, many people rather than just a few, and how much planning does this kind of thing take. But the amount of fear that it instills in people is enormous. Okay, people are afraid to go out and check their mailbox. And if you recall, many of the post offices in the Washington, D.C. and the New York area had to undergo tremendous kinds of cleaning. You know, the government buildings getting cleaning costs lots of money. Okay. Here's another case, a case of progressing paralysis. So a 35-year-old guy comes into the emergency department. He has some double vision, some droopy eyelids, some slurred speech, and difficulty swallowing. His physical exam shows nystagmus. What is nystagmus? For a parlor trick, like next time you're having drinks with friends and they're on their fifth drink or something like that, just take your finger and say, follow my finger, and just kind of run their eyes through right and left. And nystagmus is like a little bit of shaking of the eye. It's basically what the CHP would do if they pulled you over and they suspected that you were, drinking and they wanted to do a field sobriety test. They'd check your extraocular movement, see if you had any little bit of shaking in your eye. So you could see nystagmus with a lot of things. Bilateral ptosis, that's the droopy eye. I got a picture of that on the next slide, but that's basically you have droopy eyes. You look kind of like you're sleepy. And then this patient had double vision when he was asked to look on lateral gaze. So here's a slide here of droopy eye. That's what ptosis looks like. It's not that she's sleepy, but she's actually not intentionally making her eyes droop like this. They're just like that. And then this is an example of what's called a 6th cranial nerve palsy. So here the patient is looking straight ahead. The eyes are generally in the center. You ask the patient to look to his right, okay, and one eye moves to the right, but the other one doesn't. There's some kind of paralysis going on here. The muscle that usually moves this eye to the right is not working, okay, and that will give you double vision if you have that. So kind of some interesting findings in this patient that comes to the emergency department. So thinking that maybe this is some kind of stroke or something, the patient gets a CAT scan and an MRI of the brain, which are both normal. Patient conditions worsens over hours, okay, develops confusion, depressed mental state, so they're not functioning normally anymore. They start to get weakness in their upper extremities, followed by their lower extremities, and then pretty soon their respiratory effort diminishes, and they need to have a tube put down to breathe for them mechanically, okay? This lumbar puncture comes up again. Okay, so the patient gets a spinal tap. Don't think that everyone who comes to the emergency department gets a needle in their back. Okay, but this is something that you would potentially do in this particular situation to kind of see if there's any kind of brain infection going on and to rule out some other diagnoses. But don't be afraid to go to the ER. We promise we rarely try and stick needles in your back. And so the CSF, which is the fluid around the brain and the spinal cord, is normal. And again, this is a big slide that shows a lot of things, but the point here is there's a broad differential diagnosis of what this kind of paralysis could be. And the things that are more common are sort of towards the top here. People think of stroke. They think of maybe multiple sclerosis, myasthenia gravis, and Guillain-Barré. These are things that we see much more commonly. Botulism, on the other hand, is not something that we think about all that commonly, except in certain patient populations sometimes that we see here in the city. But it's much more rare, and it causes this kind of descending motor paralysis with a normal spinal tap and a normal CAT scan and a normal MRI. Okay, but we only see maybe 110 cases in California of botulism in a year. We see many more cases of stroke, let's say, in a year than we do botulism. So physicians have to think about this stuff. Okay, difficult to diagnose these bioterrorism agents. Patients admitted to the ICU. He gets some additional studies that confirm that he has botulism. The state health department gets involved. Botulinum antitoxin is really what the patient needs to help prevent the symptoms from progressing. Okay, once the symptoms are where they are, once you have paralysis, this antitoxin can't really reverse any of the symptoms, but it can prevent the progression of symptoms. Okay, so this patient's already in trouble because we're kind of behind the eight ball. They're already intubated. They're already on a ventilator. So this patient is already in a little bit of trouble. 48 hours later, some cultures of the stool are positive for C. botulinum type A. There's multiple different types of botulism. That's not really all that important. But the patient remains on a ventilator in the ICU for 6 weeks before the symptoms begin to resolve. And this is really legitimate. This is what happens, okay? So imagine a bioterrorism attack with botulism. And imagine that there are, let's just say there are hundreds of victims, maybe 1,000 victims, I don't know, all who need to be on ventilators in an intensive care unit for 6 weeks. Do we have enough ventilators? You know, do we have the resources to take care of that large of a population of people who have paralysis? Botulism is caused by C. botulinum. Again, this is another spore-forming organism, and it's another gram-positive bacillus, actually. It germinates in an anaerobic environment. So a lot of times you hear about, like, canned goods. Like, if you do home canning, that's how you can get the spores that germinate. But it's not an infection of the actual bacteria itself. It's a toxin that the bacteria produce that have the effects on your body, okay? There's three main types, an infant type, an adult type, and a wound type. This is not all that important to go into detail. But, you know, the infant type is the floppy baby that you may have heard about. Like, that's why you don't give honey to kids, because there's botulinum spores in honey, and they can germinate inside of a baby's intestines and can cause botulism. And the toxin is heat labile and can be destroyed at a temperature of 100 degrees Celsius, which is pretty high for 10 minutes, okay? Regular pasteurization doesn't give you 100 degrees Celsius for 10 minutes. This is going to be my only biology for today. So if this is making you feel a little bit sweaty and you're thinking back to 10th grade biology and you are getting nervous and you don't want to listen for the next, like, a minute, go ahead and tune out. Otherwise, for the rest of you, if you're interested in knowing why Los Angeles and Miami can have big Botox parties, this is the reason why, okay? Normal nerve conduction, okay? Your brain is going to tell, let's take the example, your brain is going to tell you to flex your arm, flex your bicep. What happens? Your brain tells a nerve in your spinal cord to send an impulse to your bicep to make it contract, okay? This is an example of the end of that nerve and your bicep muscle, okay? So I send an impulse down the nerve. When the impulse gets to the end of the nerve, it activates these little vesicles that have something called acetylcholine in them. That's what ACH stands for. And these vesicles fuse with the end of the nerve membrane, and they release their little acetylcholine into the synaptic cleft, okay? And those travel across to your bicep muscle. And once they get to the bicep muscle, they attach to some receptors there, and then that causes your muscle to contract, okay? That's basically a very simplistic way of how normal nerve function happens. In botulism, the toxin, okay, ends up at near these nerve terminals, okay? That's what these little yellow dots are representing, is botulinum toxin. And what happens is they get taken up into these vesicles, and when the nerve impulse comes down and my brain is telling my bicep to contract, okay, when it gets down to the end of this nerve, to these vesicles that now have botulinum toxin inside there, they can't fuse and they cannot release their acetylcholine into the synaptic cleft. So the transmission is lost here, Okay, this acetylcholine cannot go across to the muscle, and there is no contraction of your muscle, and you get paralysis. Okay, that's how botulinum toxin works. That's the same as Botox, right? You got a bunch of wrinkles in your forehead. That's usually caused by muscles in your forehead. If you inject some botulinum toxin into those muscles, they become flaccid, they're paralyzed, nice smooth skin. Okay, that's botulinum toxin. Okay, used a lot medically now for not just cosmetically, but in a lot of other conditions as well. So it has its uses in medicine. But what happens is in patients who are affected by botulism, okay, with botulinum toxin, usually the smaller muscles are affected first. So remember I told you this guy had double vision on his lateral gaze? The small muscles of the eye are affected first. So when he's trying to look to the right and his muscle in his eye is not working, it's not pulling his eye to the right, that's because it's a smaller muscle that's being affected by this toxin first. And then later, the larger muscles start to become affected, and you get this descending paralysis that goes from the head down to the feet. Okay. How, yeah, sure. So the question is, how come the heart muscle isn't affected? And it's only really your skeletal muscles, because your heart muscles don't undergo that same. You never tell your heart to contract. You don't sit there and say heart contract. You know, because it's under an intrinsic mechanism that doesn't have to do with the same way as all your skeletal muscles. That's the simplest way to put it. Okay. So, what's the clinical presentation for botulism? 12 to 36 hours after exposure. Again, there's a delay between the exposure and when you first see symptoms. Descending weakness, paralysis. We talked about that. I'm not going to get too much into how you actually diagnose it. And the treatment, again, is botulinum antitoxin as quickly as possible. Okay. Is this a realistic thing? You know, could someone really poison us with botulinum toxin? This has been looked at. This was a kind of a controversial article that was published in the Procedures of the National Academy of Sciences in 2005. And these guys did a mathematical model of how much botulism would need to be introduced into the milk supply to affect the maximum number of people. Okay, and basically, this is a very, you know, all I'll tell you is that this kind of diagrams how milk gets from the cows to the consumer. Okay, so here are all the cows. You know, all their milk is pooled into bigger and bigger tanks until it gets to a processing point. And at the processing point, that's when you have pasteurization, you get to the finished goods, and then it gets distributed out to the consumers again. There are a lot of different products that undergo this same kind of, what this is called, like a bow tie distribution, okay, because it looks kind of like a bow tie. But other things, juices, fruits, vegetables, might undergo the same kind of process. Okay, the way they're distributed. And what these guys looked at is, what if we introduced botulinum toxin here at the 50 kilogram gallon silos, or here at the processing lines, or here at a, you know, at the trucks, in one of the trucks. And the long story short is, if they placed the toxin in a holding tank at a farm, a tanker truck from a farm, or a raw milk silo at a plant, without early detection, okay, so if we don't have a means of really early, you know, if we don't pick up on this, on the first cases of paralysis coming in quickly, less than 1 gram of the toxin would result in 100,000 victims. 10 grams of the toxin would result in 568,000 victims. Can you imagine 568,000 victims needing respirators? Early symptomatic detection. Okay, so if 2/3 of the cases were avoided in early symptomatic detection, a 10-gram introduction of 10 grams of botulinum toxin in that area of the milk supply would still result in 100,000 poisonings. Children would be expected to be a higher percentage of victims because they're more affected. They drink more milk, probably, and they're more affected by smaller amounts of toxin. And their estimated cost for 100,000 victims would be something on the order of $17.2 million. So this hasn't happened yet, but it could happen. We don't have great means of detecting these things early. Part of the problem is this. Botulinum toxin is not completely inactivated by radiation or any heat treatment that does not adversely affect the milk's taste. So we could do ultra high temperature pasteurization, but people won't drink the milk because it doesn't taste good. Okay, so that's not really an option. We can't kill it all. We may be able to kill some with pasteurization, but we can't kill it all. And the other thing is that there are methods of detecting botulinum toxin in milk, per se. but they're not that sensitive. So, or they're too sensitive. So there might be a test that would detect botulinum, but there would be a lot of false positives. So we'd be throwing out a lot of milk that doesn't actually have any botulinum toxin in it, and that's a financial risk as well, you know, as much as it's not, may not be realistic. Okay. So I don't. In closing here, the delay to the onset of symptoms and the difficulty in detecting biologic agents make them attractive for use by terrorists. As evidenced by the anthrax attacks of 2001, biologic agents can be used successfully against the United States. It's been done. The widespread impact of attacks is dependent on many factors. It will depend on what agent is involved, the method of delivery, environmental conditions, and the speed that physicians actually identify the suspect. And the food and water supply may be areas of particular risk. So with that nice fear-mongering talk, I will take some questions. I don't know if I can answer them all, but I will take some questions. Sure. Yeah, so you have to keep in mind, so why is it that we don't see more attacks? I'll repeat it again. Why is it that we don't see more attacks? I'm making it sound a little bit easier maybe than perhaps it is. I mean, to get botulinum toxin, you know, you have to be able to... I mean, sure, we have botulinum toxin A is, you know, used in, you know, maybe the botulinum is not a good example. It might be easier to get botulinum toxin than some other things. But let's say anthrax. You have to be able to find, you have to be able to isolate it, to manufacture it in large amounts, to get it into an aerosolized form. And that's not necessarily that easy to do. It was done, though. I think by the very nature that we don't see that many attacks, it's probably more difficult than it actually seems, because otherwise I think we would see more, because this is not information that's, you know, exclusive to us. And if we're thinking about this stuff, certainly terrorists are thinking about this stuff as well. So there's more barriers, financial barriers, being able to do it covertly, making it into an easily distributable process that come into play that are probably barriers to actually widespread attacks that would occur more frequently. Okay, so your question is, or your statement is that probiotics will prevent anthrax. Is that correct? Okay. I don't know what you mean by probiotics, but prophylactic antibiotics can prevent anthrax. So we can take ciprofloxacin, okay, which is an antibiotic, and prevent ourselves from getting anthrax once we know that we could be possibly exposed to anthrax. But we can't be taking ciprofloxacin all the time, right? So the government is stockpiling ciprofloxacin in the city and the state. We have stockpiles of ciprofloxacin so that we can protect other people from getting anthrax when an event occurs. Okay, so it is preventable once we have identified an outbreak of anthrax. So the second comment is that fiber for botulinum toxin has the potential to remove the toxin from the body. Again, I hadn't heard that. Okay, as far as I know, really once you have this toxin in your body, in order to prevent it from spreading, you need antitoxin, botulinum antitoxin. And antitoxin, again, is another thing that the government, the states, cities, city planning is stockpiling antitoxin as well for in the event that we have a botulism outbreak from a terrorist attack. Okay, so I didn't tell you that, but the 110 cases that we see in California a year, okay, are primarily in the IV drug user population. And the reason is because botulism, again, as I told you, is found in the soil. And our IV drug using population uses a lot of stuff called black tar heroin, which is a very dirty form of heroin. And they often inject it under the skin. And so the botulism organism gets underneath the skin. And once it gets under the skin, it starts to grow. And when it grows, it produces the toxin. And so most of the cases that we see in California are in that patient population. And that's what this case is describing. Sure, in the back. The question is, what is the botulism antitoxin? And how come it doesn't reverse the effects once the effects are there? The answer to the second part of your question is that once the nerves take up this toxin, the antitoxin can't get it out, okay? It can only prevent it from getting in, you know, but once it's in, it can't really prevent it from being there anymore, so it doesn't really remove it from the body. And the specifics of how the antitoxin is produced, I don't know the specifics of how it's produced. Ricin is, it's not really a biological agent, okay? So I could have had a whole nother lecture on chemical agents or plant. Ricin is actually from a plant or plant-like agents that could be used as possible terrorist agents. So that's why it's not in this lecture. But again, so that's the problem with this lecture topic is that you could go on and on and on about, I'm trying to get to that. So this list is all of, these are all biologic agents, okay, either viruses or bacteria that could be used by it in the event of terrorism, okay. That's why things like ricin aren't there, or for instance, like you've heard of sarin gas, or, you know, these are all more chemical agents that can be used as terrorist threats. We have to consider all of these, okay. The ones that would be sort of, you know, what would be, I'm not sure if I understand your question correctly. You're asking me what I think is the biggest threat out of all of these. I mean, I would say that all of these are potential threats. I can't really rank them necessarily. They all have, like, different pluses and minuses, right? I mean, like, for instance, smallpox, that was something that was eradicated in the 1960s and 1970s and that we have a vaccine for, okay? But, and that vaccine has actually been stockpiled as well. It's so, like, you know, smallpox as a virus is very easily transmitted, so respiratorily, okay, whereas anthrax, like, you can't pass it from one person to the other, so that maybe makes that a little bit lower of a threat as opposed to smallpox, which is more rapidly disseminated in a population. I mean, that, you know, so Botulism is probably, of all of them, the most toxic of all the agents, the most lethal of all of them, okay? The smallest amount that will kill you is probably botulism. So they all have, you know, pick your poison, I guess. I don't know what to say. I mean, when you go to the CDC website, okay, and you look at, you know, what are the agents that people are thinking about and what are we prepared for, these are the ones that the government that, you know, physicians, the health department have thought about and have prepared for, or have at least tried to prepare for in the event of a terrorist attack. I don't know what it is about that area of the country that that the brown recluse spider likes, but that is just where it's known to be found, like, indigenous to in the United States. Some of those areas are not that warm, you know. Like Missouri and, you know, kind of the upper Midwest, it gets a little bit into there. And some other places like Florida, that's very tropical, doesn't have the brown recluse spider. So I can't tell you the effects of global warming, but could be possible. I don't know. Maybe we'll see more brown recluse spider bites in California in the future. How is anthrax diagnosed? And can it be diagnosed in time to treat it? So there's two types of anthrax. There's pulmonary anthrax and there's cutaneous anthrax or skin anthrax. And pulmonary anthrax it's going to be pretty advanced by the time you're going to make the diagnosis, right? Like the guy who came in severely sick and septic, he's already in shock. Okay, and he did the spinal tap and they saw that it was there. That's pretty progressed already. Okay, so that's... Can it be treated? Yes, because you saw that of the 10 cases of inhalational anthrax, 5 of them survived. So if you get appropriate antibiotics in them, they can be treated and they can survive with good supportive care. But then again, a 50% mortality is pretty high. So if you guys have more questions, you can come up here and ask me more. Thank you for your time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.